You know this one, Max?
No, but it's wonderful.
Sir, you surely
that
did.
Change right there.
Here we go.
Oh.
Yeah.
Oh, turn it up. Turn it up.
Fuck yeah. Number one hit.
Yeah.
There you go.
The Righteous Brothers must have been so pumped to get a number one in like 1977.
They must have never thought that was going to happen.
What it makes me think about is how it's like, you know, as marijuana developed over the decades, it was at the perfect strength right around then. It's like right. For that to be the type of record that people want to put on the radio and listen to, it's like, yes.
What year did it come out, Johnny?
76, maybe?
Because I like to think of drugs by the mid-70s of really, they've taken out all the good people. You're into that kind of paranoid, like Vietnam era, kind of post-Nixon America, which is where the drugs were a bit stronger than everyone realized. I think that maybe more the Righteous Brothers' Rock and Roll Heaven, because the song's about ostensibly the 27 Club and other guys we lost and gals we lost along the way. You know, I like to think
and only
it's
kind of an only the strong survive too sort of thing.
It's
is what you're talking about.
Early boomer bait song, I think. More.
Right.
You know,
but only the strong. It's like they couldn't handle the drugs the way those of us who are still around could.
There's no way the Righteous Brothers were doing drugs.
None at all.
Well, they, you know, the ones who slipped, they went to sleep. You can't go to sleep.
At the
you
wheel.
Gotta stay up. Yeah, especially you gotta stay up.
Especially if Clapton's right. about, you know. Greasing, I mean, if you,
they
you
slipped
know.
Up. I like.
I remember
slipped,
I read
yeah.
the Hendrix biography.
He slipped
up. Well, it sounds like his. I mean, he actually sounded pretty balanced. He didn't seem that out of control.
Mm-hmm.
I think just one night he just took. He didn't realize that the Swedish sleeping pills were like way stronger.
Yeah,
and he took a lot. But there's also some weird stuff around that, like the way that they handled it when they kind of freaked out. It was really weird. I think that gal he was dating. It's kind of on her. She should have like called the cops.
Well, you know,
are
Stevie,
you suggesting?
Stevie
are
Ray
you
Vaughan
suggesting?
Has a theory.
Yeah, yeah. You're suggesting that foul play may have been happening.
I'm suggesting at the worst a negligent homicide.
Wow.
Perhaps. Yeah.
The first
Stevie
48.
Ray Vaughan. There's a great interview with SRV that he's just like he's really intense, looking into the camera, and he's like, "Let's just say," he's like, he almost doesn't want to say it. He's like, "I just want to say, you know, I don't think."
He says he has inside information.
I don't think it was an accident. And he's like, okay,
what?
Enough said kind of thing.
Yeah, I don't think it's
he knows
wise
something.
For me to talk anymore about it. That's what he
right.
says.
And what happened to him?
And Clapton saw the interview and he's like, oh, here, this is your copter, Stevie. Here we go.
Yeah, exactly.
You want to talk about those kind of secrets?
Yeah,
hop in
exactly.
the copter.
You know
let's go for a little ride.
You know it. Well, ladies
you know
and gentlemen,
what's going on,
we're joined by Max Frost. On Impossible Way of Life, your bi-weekly rock and roll podcast, more so a kind of Beatles-y podcast than ever.
In essence.
And, you know, Max, I've been looking at your Wikipedia. That's how I find out about people. And I noticed it says on there, after you've had quite a sort of run, a distinguished kind of career, moving around and stuff, but it does say on there that your favorite band's the Beatles.
Yeah, I mean...
Isn't everyone's favorite band the Beatles?
Definitely mine.
No, definitely not. There's a lot of people who don't get it. But not really.
No.
I just say that anyone who's not getting it is just not. They're not. I don't know. That's sort of like saying Michael Jordan's not. It's just, you know what I mean. It's just kind of like it is what it is, man.
Yeah. Haters, man. Haters.
It is what it is.
It's a little bit like anyone. We've said this before in the podcast. Anyone who doesn't get it, they need a kind of. Robin
Hug.
Williams, Goodwill Hunting style scenario. Like, and it's not your fault style kind of moment.
I thought she more meant what they need is the speech by the pond where it's like, if I asked you about the Rolling Stones, you probably tell me you've heard a couple of songs.
Yeah.
If I asked you about the White Album, you probably give me a skinny, give me some of your personal favorites.
Yeah.
Exactly. Exactly.
Everyone needs
I've literally been at a bar before and had a guy in like a tight fitting leather jacket that's like, he's run over it with his motorcycle on
They're
purpose
who
and stuff.
These guys.
Yeah, and
who
he
fans.
Comes in and he's all tense, you know, at the shoulders. And I'm like, oh, you know, I was just at home, like listening to Abbey Road or whatever. And he's like, fucking hate the Beatles, like that, nice. You know? And I literally, I just put my hand on his shoulders and I just slightly start to just massage a little bit. And I'm just, it's so, he's like, get your fucking hands off me, you piece of shit.
Let
and I'm
him
like, just
in,
him.
Yeah.
I'm like, man, it's okay. You know what I mean? It's all right. So, and then I give a look over to the bartender and he throws on like Here, There, and Everywhere or something. Yep. And then you just see the love
and this
come
happened.
And
this happened
the tears
life,
start to fall, you know?
Are you from Liverpool, Jay?
I'm from Manchester, but I'm from slightly south of Manchester. So I'm really, it's really close. It's like really close. To, it's like kind of, I mean, I identify as Mancunian, I suppose. Well, I mean, I'm from there. That was close. So that's like 10 kilometers away in Liverpool. It'd probably be like 30 or 40. But it all it blends a little bit, you know?
Yeah. Well, the Liverpool accent now sounds really different than it, you know, well, my exposure to it was them.
True.
It was the Beatles.
True.
They sound young guy, like a guy my age I met from Liverpool somewhere in Berlin. He sounded way different.
He fucking sounded like this.
Yeah. They also fucking, it's like, it's way more nasal.
He fucking sounded like, no, you sounded a bit more like you in the fucking Beatles. This is what they sound like now.
Yeah.
They're not even real people from Liverpool. They're all aliens from the 60s, trapped in the 60s. It's really interesting. Because, like,
it's a weird part of the world.
It is. Growing up there, like, in Manchester, obviously, we have got our fucking Liam and Noel fucking, we got out and fucking mad for the kid shit, you know, fucking As You Were. And, like, we've got our own music, you know, obviously, like, a lineage of, you know, music from, you know, Hacienda stuff, Baggy, Joy Division, Goth, New Order, and then it's Stone New Roses, Order. Oasis, you know, and all that stuff. And there's a lot of stuff around the sides, but Liverpool's only about 30 minutes away, 40 minutes away. And I used to go there in bands and play, and they were still doing skiffle.
Like Liverpool is 40 minutes away from Manchester?
Yeah, like 40, 50 minutes away. And they're still doing skiffle over there. Like, it is
how
like
is
a different...
the accent that different if it's
that like that
close,
in England?
Man.
You've seen this guys and girls on Instagram will do a little whip around the whole British Isles, you know? You know,
Even Ireland, that's smaller. My Irish family, they'll do all the accents, even just in the north, and they're totally different. Like,
that's pretty cool.
Yeah, we kind of, I don't know why it is. I suppose a lot of it is just like Britain is like a very old place and it's like historical regionality and a lot of inbreeding. So people just kind of maintain their local, you know, tribal identities. You know, they're kind of medieval. You know, like kind of vibe. People don't move around much, you know, like it's only like, I think this is actually an interesting point that, and totally not about music, but I've lived in North America for about 20 years. And obviously in the New World, not the Terrence Malick movie, which was an abomination, but, in the New World, you know, everyone's got these like very mixed fluid identities and are very interested in, you know, their roots. And you don't experience that in England because you're just English, you know. Until industrialization, there would have been no one there other than really English people just kind of who hadn't moved. I mean, I'm probably related to someone who's from my village from like 5,000 years ago still, you know. Mm-hmm. And I'm lucky I don't look like I have one eye or something. You know, it could have been bad.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm,
yeah.
Mm-hmm.
So...
Max Frost, we'd like to welcome you again to Impossible Way of Life. I'd just like to tell our listeners and everyone a little bit how this came about. So we have a beloved friend of the pod and a patron of our show named Evan Charles. I don't know if that's his real name. I believe so.
I've always done him as Evan Butts, but I don't know.
People use handles, you know, people use handles on the Discord, you know.
Yeah. And so he basically, we did an episode, and as happens on the internet, we stumbled upon one of your recent, you're doing a tournament of mashups where you will pit one band against another, but covering each other's songs.
Yes.
And in sort of a March Madness tournament style bracket, which is something that we like to have fun with occasionally. And we were talking about how much we enjoyed it. And I guess he heard it, and he reached out and said that we should have you on. And he said that you have a rich history in living the impossible way of life that is being a musician. And I asked him the other day, I said, what should we talk to Max about when we have him on the show? And he said, I feel like this is a smoky backroom meeting of the two preeminent classic rock-oriented bracketologists working today. So perhaps a discussion of similarities and differences of eyewall methodology versus frost methodology. And then he said, maybe his experience on a major label, what that was like. He had a song in an Old Navy commercial a few years ago. And then he said his story is that of a young bluesman's journey into the mainstream. Probably some kind of a narrative angle there. So, you know, from that, I'm not...
to digest there, yeah.
From that, I gather, like I was saying, you've got a long and journeyed past. Well, maybe not so long, because you told me you were only 31 years old on the phone yesterday. Yeah. But... You are a musician. You make records. You also do all of this cool content on the internet that seems like it takes a lot of effort to create. And so I don't know. Like maybe why don't you tell us a little bit? And for people listening who might not know your music or who you are, what do you like to say that you do mostly in this world?
These days I don't talk much about what I do if a stranger asks. Since I moved to Nashville, saying that you're a musician is a pretty cliche thing. And sure. It's interesting. People don't ask a follow-up question in Nashville about that, which is interesting. Which I used to hate how when I lived in places like LA, there was all these follow-up questions kind of sizing you up. Like, well, yep. They're trying to figure out, like, are you famous? Whereas in Nashville, if you say you're a musician, they're just like, oh, cool. Anyways, they're just like, that's boring.
Liberating, though? Is that a liberating feeling?
A little bit. I don't know. I mean,
anonymity to some extent.
Well, I hate that my answer for what I do gives people the assumption that I'm living on my mom's couch and playing writer's rounds or something like that. No disrespect to anyone who is up to that. I do also want to take a second to take a step back and throw credit to Evan Butts to partly answer this question. First of all, Evan is a brilliant writer and a brilliant mind, I think, as demonstrated by even that short paragraph that he wrote.
For sure.
I met Evan when he was in a band called The Days, and we were all like, I wasn't even quite in high school yet. They were still in high school. Evan's a little bit older than me. And we would play in this place called Jovita's that was this venue in Austin that, to make a long story short, we played at very often, and that the people who ran it, who were friends of mine, you know, both the family and I went to school with some of their kids, they it was always a mysteriously underfunded situation, this restaurant, but it always seemed to kind of exist. And we played probably 50 to 100 gigs there. And then one day after we had stopped playing there, the FBI busted in and it turned out that it was this big heroin ring. And we had been friends with the head of the Texas Syndicate King, which you can Google all that. It's incredible. But that's just one quick connection to Evan Butts. But to explain, like, what I do, I give people a background. So Austin, Texas is a very musical town that kind of has no genre dominance. There is a blues thing. There is kind of a country Texas thing, but there, you know, there's bands like Spoon have come from there.
Of course, yeah.
Gary Clark Jr., Fastball. Blues. Like there's a lot of melting pot.
Fastball, did you say? Nice.
Yeah, they're from there. And that had a big effect on me. And I also came into really obsessing with music around the time that Napster was something that I could download to my mom's desktop computer.
Mm-hmm.
And so explaining all that to say that, you know, like I was kind of more this blues guy. Evan was more kind of this folk rock guy, but I never really registered much of a genre classification in any of that. It was just kind of this melting pot of music. And so that kind of led me to be a bit of a chameleon mm-hmm. with the people that I worked with and the things that I worked on. And I think it was kind of through that openness to do whatever came my way, which especially the big revolution in what I was doing was I had been just in bands trying to like write our songs and take our band into the studio and cut something. And I was always kind of disappointed by how that turned out. And then when I started working with hip hop guys, it was like, oh, whoa, this is, we're making the record on the spot in the studio. And it sounds a lot more like what's on the radio quickly than what I'm doing with my band. That led to me kind of just being a stoner who made beats and songs on his laptop that I went to the University of Texas for a year, dropped out, kept pushing music, put some on SoundCloud. This is back when Spotify wasn't quite a thing yet, and the blogosphere, like Hype Machine and all that, was a thing.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And that there was a song called White Lies and a song called Nice and Slow that I put up there that found some love on blogs that made it go viral for a little bit. And I signed a deal with Atlantic Records. This would have been in 2013. And I was on Atlantic for like 7 years. I've swapped labels now. I've toured a lot. I discovered the TikTok world when that sort of became like a bridge I just knew I had to cross, and found this niche of the mashup thing really just through imitation. I saw other people doing it, and to be honest, thought they were doing a pretty bad job. So I was like, well, I'll give it a go. And it's mm-hmm. been, but some people are great at it too.
I've got to say, like, I kind of, yeah, came across your stuff organically on Instagram. I'm not very good. I've not kind of made the progression to TikTok in terms of
right.
really understanding how it works. But like, I came across your Beatles Corn thing just organically, probably because it just kind of showed up on my Explore page. And yeah. it was pretty fucked, man. Like, that must have taken you a really long time to do.
You'd be amazed at how not that long it takes on it. And I don't mean that I've done it so many times now. Like I started doing that in 2020.
Yeah.
And it was mainly, this is before Instagram became TikTok.
Yeah, yeah, of course.
Now,
yeah.
basically. So, and I would post it on Instagram too, but it didn't do very well because they hadn't figured out how to just imitate that algorithm yet. But
yes,
I mean, it was literally like, because it was the first thing in my whole career that I could do online. Because here's my whole career. My whole career has been music that has found its way into the community of people in the world to some degree. But then like my actual like existence doesn't quite like follow. So I've always had this like low social yeah. numbers, big yeah. streams comparatively, right?
Uh-huh.
And so this was the first time I was ever doing something where it was like getting a real like audience online, and it was honestly the validation of it was super addicting. So I just sat there and rinsed and repeated that shit over and over and over and over.
Right.
And I don't even know how many I've made. I mean, some of them wouldn't do well, some of them would do super well.
I've kind of deep dived, you know, through like at least your Instagram stuff, and it seems like you started, like, you kind of nailed the like Damon Albarn gorillas thing pretty early yeah. on, like kind of yeah. gorillarizing popular songs.
That's
which
pretty
leads,
doable.
Leads
yeah.
me to it. Leads me to a question. You know, for like, I'm genuinely interested in this. Like,
yeah,
everyone wants to know how Damon Albarn, what kind of processing that guy's actually using to get that voice going. What are you doing? What's your kind of workaround to get that kind of telephone voice?
Well, I think first of all, it starts with that he is.
Yeah,
almost
no.
barely breathing when he's singing.
Oh, okay.
That
I thought
stuff.
You were going to say he's really good, because he is, but yeah, almost barely breathing.
Well, yeah,
breathing.
I mean, it's, yes, it also, first of all, starts off with him being a complete fucking genius, but yeah. All those guys. But in fact, I remember that Feel Good Inc. video when it would come onto the Insomniac channel on MTV at night or VH1, whatever it was, that just blowing. Like, that was really one of the pieces of music that around the time I was like 10 or 11, 12, whatever that was. That was just like a mind-blowing thing. Like,
yeah, I had a similar reaction to him. I'm a little bit older than you, but I've obviously like a massive Blur fan, probably because I'm a little older yeah. in English. It was easier to, you know, that was just kind of ubiquitous with growing up in the 90s. But yeah. I remember thinking it was such a weird move when the Gorilla stuff came out, and like not really understanding why it was so good. Because, you know, and I think that, like, it's funny. I think, you know, history is kind of, well, he's on the right side of it for sure. Because they're, you know, I saw him at the stadium here recently, you know. It was wild. And he's, you know, barely needs to even be there. He can just get his little kind of cartoons up there if he wants.
I think it's him. I think it's Brian, you know, Danger Mouse.
Yeah.
I mean, all those guys are just, I mean, Danger Mouse is probably, in my opinion, one of the more significant figures of the past 20 years of music.
I was reading recently about Danger Mouse. Like, this is kind of like, it started as like something funny that I was reading, but then it got a bit serious and a bit kind of twisted and demented. Mm. Like, I was laughing because I remembered that like Jack White and the Black Keys had a feud in like about 2015. And Johnny, I called him up and he remembered. It's really funny because it's basically Jack White was kind of like, on the surface, it sounds like he's like, they're ripping me off. I invented blues. Like, that's kind of like what he's saying. He's like, you know, they wouldn't be doing what they're doing. I mean, I'm not sure he invented blues, but the two-piece thing, the colors in the band name.
Hard,
you know,
hard blues from the 2000s
he
invented.
Hard blues. So
without bass.
You know, and then I was reading, though, like, if you actually read up on it, it gets pretty weird, because Jack White sounds like a bit of a bully, right? Like, in general. And I know that...
Do you see him around Nashville? Before we tell this story, he might be your buddy.
No, I will. I don't know where this is going. I will separately say that I actually got. I did meet Brian Danger Mouse, and I went and met him on his birthday at his house, and it was the coolest thing ever. And I had to just desperately hide inside how badly I wanted to be his friend.
Yeah, and just, I've done that before with someone.
Kept it cool. So I don't know if this is going toward a Danger Mouse thing or not.
Yeah, it is. The Danger Mouse thing is, well, basically, like, one of the kind of things that Jack White has beef with is that he went to work with Danger Mouse, and then the Black Keys immediately went to work with them as well. So, like, Danger Mouse is like a pivot. Like, Jack White was kind of like, I'm going to work with this guy because this guy is, like, obviously, like, a genius, you know? Yeah. It's probably after the Broken Bells stuff when he started pivoting into more indie. So he moved to Nashville. And then the Black Keys moved to Nashville, tried to work with Danger Mouse, and put their kids in the same elementary school as Jack White's.
That's interesting. I mean, well, first of all, everyone wants to work with Danger Mouse.
Yeah,
right?
I think
like, anyone in alternative music wanted to work with that guy. So I don't think that that's like rare or a ripoff. I would also say that Jack White, what's unique to me about Jack White is that he looks like a Tim Burton character and has a really weird voice. I don't really like, it's unique, but also unhinged, his vibrato and his guitar playing. He's done some really cool stuff. I really respect the guy. I don't give a flying fuck what he thinks about some other band ripping him off. I mean, that's insane. That's crazy, dude.
Yeah.
Yeah, he seems like an angry man.
If what you do can be ripped off, it's probably not that dope. Stevie Wonder isn't out there whining about some, you know what I mean? Like, you, if you're that great, you can't really be ripped off.
But
is Freddie Mercury getting ripped off? No, because you can't.
You did a pretty good job in that recent Queen mashup of doing
Freddie. But I can't
even
get close. I mean, he's like untouchable. Like, that's insane.
So for people who aren't aware of the video that I'm talking about, you did a Beatles version of Freak on a Leash. Yeah. And I can't remember.
I thought the corn was Dear Prudence.
Dear Prudence. Yeah.
Which I thought actually was superior personally.
Well, it won. It won out.
Yeah. It was really good. Yeah.
And how did that make you feel? Kind of like, you know, you've got this bracket going. You're probably thinking, like, it'll be more fun, I'm assuming, to continue to do Beatles-y versions of songs. And Korn, like, out. Who's voting here? How does
yeah,
it, what's
now
the
you
voting?
Have to do, like, now you Korn have to, covered are you, Stevie Wonder.
Are you being dragged by your followers? That's what I want to know.
I think, you know, that I started with that one in the bracket because I thought, oh, well, this will be a nice, weird one to just get the blood flowing here on this again. I had taken a long hiatus from doing the mashups, and I thought, well, this one's a really odd pairing, and it's not going to work. I thought, I don't think I'll even be able to get that close to Korn, because, and what people are going to be really disappointed to find out here in these next few rounds, once Korn's back again up at bat, is that, like, I don't have this, like, deep grasp of their sound. Like, I'm not going to be able to, like, not going to be referencing deeper cuts.
I think,
man,
it's,
like, it's going to be the same thing.
I think it's just line six and crystal meth.
Oh, yeah. Oh, that's what I did. No, I snorted an Adderall right off of this countertop.
Exactly.
Before.
I think that's it.
Actually, I was going to ask you something, because I was like, okay, this is something I wanted to, because I was going through your Instagram before we continue with the mashups thing, which is great and hilarious. Because I was looking through your Instagram and I was like, okay, as far as I can see in like a 10-minute scanning of this, this guy is an original singer, songwriter, producer, arranger. He does all of these crazy mashups, really, like, high quality videos. He does, like, a cooking kind of style thing a lot, where you do incredible cooking and those videos are edited. I think at one point maybe you had a podcast, because there was a lot of videos with podcasting. So my question is, what drugs do you take and are they available in Canada?
No. In fact, it's funny you even asked that. I actually stopped drinking like four
See, I think,
months
I
ago.
Knew it. I
James
knew it.
Nailed
I
it.
Knew it. I said the only way that this motherfucker is doing the amount of work he's doing is if he's sober. There's no way. No one. It's like, unless he's got the limitless drugs, Like, yeah. Which, you know, you can't. Well,
that's what I was hoping. That's what I was hoping.
That's so funny. I tried, during the pandemic, I was trying a technique of doing drinking a lot and doing a lot of drugs while doing all these videos. It's more work. It's just more work.
Turns
man.
Out
it doesn't work.
Yeah.
No,
yeah.
Which ones are those? I want to watch those ones. Are they on Instagram?
Oh, I mean, everything up until the most recent 4 months.
Dude, I do want to ask you, though. That's funny. Yeah. And good for you for getting sober.
Yeah, thank you.
But, okay, and more serious, but similar. I actually am curious about this because your productivity does seem to be very impressive. What is your morning routine? I do want to know this. Like,
I wish I could tell you it's great. It's really just, I wake up, I immediately grab my phone. I immediately check Instagram. I immediately, these days, I'm like recently single. I'll check on like dating
Congratulations.
Apps, check him, you know, I'll be like, oh,
congratulations.
And then, you know, get
coffee?
Up.
Coffee?
Oh, dude, I am drinking like.
You're a fresh pot guy.
Obscene amounts of caffeine right now.
Yeah.
Like, I'm talking two servings of like strong cold brew minimum.
Okay.
And then Coke Zero throughout the day.
Yeah.
So that's.
Yeah, you've replaced.
I don't even know. I don't want to know what the measurement is.
Yeah.
But I finally figured out I got
constantly keyed on caffeine. Yeah.
Past 3-4 p.m., I gotta start backing it off because I've started to have a thing where I'll just wake up at 3 in the morning with my heart racing.
Right.
Just like
jump on Instagram, make a quick mashup, go back to bed.
Onto Raya, you know?
Exactly. Yeah. No, but I will say sobriety has certainly made the mashup videos feel way. I don't know why. I'm like my edge with them just is easier now.
Yeah.
Because it almost takes like. The way I would say what that is it's like you have to be able to think in an extremely abstract way about music and, but also kind of know fairly concretely like why things sound the way they sound, you know, like,
right.
Like going back to the David Auburn thing, like he sounds like that because of the way he sings, but also just like knowing that, it's just like a really narrow EQ spectrum. It's like a little distorted, but it's not crunchy. It's like very compressed. And there's just certain people that I can just sound more like as a singer. Like I think I can sound more like him or Brandon Flowers than I can like Freddie Mercury because of the shape of my skull. I don't have enough of an overbite or enough of just the ass wind to do Freddie. I mean, he's
right.
There's one guy in Vegas who I've seen who can do him miraculously well.
Freddie?
Who I've actually, he can do Freddie Mercury. Yeah. I tried to DM and be like, hey man, do you want to do one of these with me? And he never responded. But I would love to start finding more singers, male or female, who've got great singer impressions because that's kind of to me the spirit of it.
Yeah.
And then the spirit of it is really what is the essence of how this act or this singer, how they sing their songs and what is the musical feeling? Because to really get it too, you kind of have to reharmonize the songs, reimagine their tempos, like you're kind of reimagining songs through the lens of an artist more than it is just like try to have a band play that song. Sometimes it works like that, but sometimes it doesn't work. To me, it's more fun when it's the challenge of like, wow, this shouldn't work. But if you think, I always have myself convinced by the end that like, you know what, Dear Prudence, really, if you think about it, it is a Korn song.
Yeah.
You know, it's like, it is this weird song.
Yeah, that's true.
That they would totally
have
done.
That's interesting, man. Yeah.
I think that like, obviously, you know, if I could define kind of what I think of the impossible way of life as being, obviously it's a reference from The Last Waltz. Robbie says it at one point, but. Yeah. It's about musicians, particularly musicians in sort of this like time, like this sort of post-historical, post-streaming, you know, time, like, you know, trying to find a way to exist, you know, as a musician. And obviously look at me and Johnny here. I mean, like we're musicians, producers, I do a lot of mixing. I'm a mixing engineer as well. And we've had like small pockets of indie level success, you know, on a very, very small scale, you know, and we have a podcast and that's like one way in which we can communicate, make a bit of money, talk to other artists and people. And, you know, I think that like what I'm trying to get at is obviously like you, I'm assuming, have diversified what you do from being just a purely formally a singer-songwriter or an artist, you know, to keep probably the lights on. You're like, what else can I do? You know, to generate one income, to like notoriety and fans. And one thing I'd be interested to know is, does your notoriety with mashups and with kind of content, which is wonderful, have like a consequence on people listening to your music that you create for yourself, for others, as Max Frost? Is there a correlation between those two things?
I think that there is a loose correlation, but I would first of all say that to my frustration, it has been two separate things.
Yeah.
I hoped that what would happen was, you know, especially as I just saw the sheer magnitude of the viewership of this mashup stuff, I thought, gosh, if I could, and I still every day go, how can I convert these people to listen full time?
Could still
to
happen,
my music?
Obviously. Yeah.
It could. I mean, I think, look, I don't, the time we're in, what you just said about, you know, this postmodern era of what does it mean for music? I mean, I don't want to ramble too long or get too macabre, but
yeah. Get into it, brother.
I think that what we're entering is a really, I made a New Year's resolution, which was I'm going to just remain curious about what's happening with music, culture, and technology. I'm not mm-hmm. going to be pessimistic about it, because all you can do is hope that as quickly as it got weird, it could get unweird. I don't know. I mean, I'm doing a song and dance online because it's entertaining. I mean, I do have fun doing it. Like, it's funny.
So. You must. I would hope so. Yeah. And I had fun watching it too. I think that's the important thing to just, I want you to know that. Like, I liked it. I thought it was good. Yeah. I followed along. Like, and I think that there's an inherent value in that in terms of performance and enjoyment, because you're an
entertainer. You're an entertainer. Yeah.
Exactly.
Yeah. And I wouldn't have reached out if I thought that it was like lame or weird or anything. Like, I thought you were sort of a man of, after our own heart. Like, it was funny, but it was like well done, and you clearly are a talented musician. So it was kind of like, but it did spark our curiosity with what James is saying, right? Because obviously I can see that, and like from me knowing that, like, you know, content creation and all that kind of stuff, that I was like, I bet you that he wants this to translate into listeners of his own original soulful music that he's creating, and I wonder if it is, you know? I thought the same thing.
In a small way, not in the way you'd hope. I mean, it's interesting, right? I mean, I've been putting out music for 10 years, and I've had a handful of songs really create a real pulse for themselves and build me a small audience. I've gotten to open on tour for some really amazing bands that has also kind of, you know, put some water into the bathtub with all that. But it's been very slow. There's been cold years. There's been hot years. The TikTok thing, it's wild looking back that this is almost, you know, I'm in the fourth year of doing. And when I say the TikTok thing, I mean the new internet space of algorithmic fragmentation and disassociation.
Sure.
Yeah. What we now have entered, there was a global pandemic, and then at the same time, this mysterious, it's almost become this like mythic religion in music where we pray to the, we wake up and God give us this day our daily content. We're going to pray to the algorithm and hope that it bestoweth upon us more success.
Sure.
And that's entered us into what I would say is sort of a strange dark age for a dark age on the business, what the hell are we all doing side. But I think also there's a lot of positive things about the creative aspect, and that no one's walking around anymore. There's no A&R guys being like, oh, dude, well, what you got? Like, I think you got a this and you got a that, and that's how you're going to have success. They now have to all go, okay, we don't know. This thing is crazy. It's a fugazi, it's a fugazi. Who freaking knows? Maybe someone's going to take a video of a chicken kissing a pig, and that's going to magically make this song
I'd
explode.
Watch that.
We have no idea.
Yeah.
But where, to me, the technology and the pandemic more just hit the fast forward button on, I think, a deeper disconnection that's happening right now with culture and music, which is that there was once a time when making music was a more dangerous thing to do. It was a culturally more taboo thing to do. The Beatles were offensive to people. Mm-hmm. In fact, there's a video. Elvis was very offensive to people, but so were the Beatles. So were all these things.
Yeah.
There was something actually very counterculture about what they were doing. And I think that that gets lost on people now, how out there it really was. And that unfortunately, not unfortunately, but it just is what it is, that now it's not that dangerous. It's not culturally dangerous. It's not risky. It's not taboo to make music of any kind. And I think for that reason, And also the technological barrier to entry is so low that there's so many people jumping into it now that when you have a platform where everyone's sort of leveled at the same space to come to the marketplace and be like, hey, I've got a song out, you should check it out. It's not just that there's so much noise in the cloud space of everyone showing up to Instagram and TikTok to talk about their music. It's more that we're kind of like, we're not as culturally moved. We're not as like, oh, wow, this is so important and speaks mm-hmm. to what we can't quite say. In fact, I would really say that the people who seem to be more on the dangerous end, who are exploding and seeming more like they're touching on something in the culture that feels like it's got a big reaction, the new rock stars are the stand-up comedians because they are actually taking a risk. They're out there doing something and saying something.
It's a really hard it's job. This might be the hardest one, I think. Mm-hmm.
That's the hardest art form on the planet.
I think it's the hardest one.
10-year run just to even get...
yeah.
Like, you can do it. You
people
know?
Get mm-hmm. addicted to it, too. I know a couple of people who do it, and they're not of, you know, any, like, massive repute, you know, yet. But they're once they start, they said it's really addicting. Like, you know, being out there and, like, getting that laugh and stuff, you know, which is probably a similar feeling to, well, one, having recognition for songs that you'd written or playing shows and people responding. But I would imagine as well, like, you know, getting 50,000 views or like likes or follows overnight, it must be something that's very surreptitious that you kind of like, you want to kind of, when, you know, like, what's the next step? I bet you, you know, you can enjoy that kind of dopamine hit for like, I don't know, like 30 minutes and you're like, well, I need to get 200,000 now.
Yeah, it's a diminishing return, and it doesn't change. Well, look, I mean, that thing went well enough where I started making real money from some of that. So
that's interesting,
right?
To me. That like makes me really happy, actually. So you can generate income.
Me too.
You can generate income from your like your kind of if you're kind of split down the middle, and you've got like your you know internet entertainment stuff, and then your work as a as Max Frost.
Like yeah, for a while I could.
Yeah, you can find money. I mean, you've got some songs that have streamed really well. I mean, and that if I know people who own their masters and have had that happen, and you can really generate some cash.
Yeah.
Yeah, but Atlantic probably had a piece of that, I guess.
Yeah, there it is. Stay on it.
What label
Craig
are you with?
Kelman, you've got to give up the masters. He's got to give his masters back over. He's not going to do it.
With a different record company now or no?
I am with Network now,
Network.
Which is a Canadian-based label. But they're about
we know
big
all
as
about
an indie
it.
Can be. Yeah.
They are. They're massive these days. Yeah, I know people who've signed for them down in
but
LA.
They've been great.
From LA. That's good. Yeah.
Yeah.
That's cool. A very different... Now it's...
Aren't they in Vancouver?
I think so. They're mainly based out of there. But this has been the best era for me as far as how much I enjoy what I do. Because the cool thing is now I don't feel like I've got like this major corporation breathing down my neck trying to only... They only want to hear a hit and they're going to know what a hit is. That's a horrible position to be in.
Well, you should run away from people like those. Like people like that. Like anyone who says they can predict a hit, like you just got to run as far away from them as possible, I think.
Yeah, it's tough, man. I mean, some people kind of can in a way. You know, it's more that even if they're batting 55%, they're going to tell you about 100% of their 55%. But
I really want, this is really interesting to me, and I think like we're going to have to, it'd be awesome if you'd come back and talk to us more, Max, because there's a lot to get into here, and I'm curious about it legitimately as well. But I have a lot of friends who are younger right now who are in bands who are sort of, and they're super talented musicians, and they're like in their prime of writing songs and everything's going, and they ask me a lot, not that I have any answers at all, but you know, they're trying to figure it out. Like, I need to get signed to a label, like a cool label, like, you know, a cool indie label. And I need to get the right publicist that's going to get me on Jimmy Fallon or whatever it is. Mm-hmm. And I tell them, like, that sure, like, that would be all great and everything. But, like, part of me thinks that there must be a changing of the guard happening soon that maybe, like, we don't need any of that. You know what I mean? And I'm curious what your opinion is about labels and about, do you think that it's actually necessary, or do you think that it's almost possible now that if you have the drive and, like, business acumen and work ethic...
And a flat to do, of Coke Zero.
In a flat of Coke Zero, that, like, you can just create your own great music and hustle and kind of achieve and do promote yourself, you know, effectively.
Yeah, because everything that you just talked about that they would be seeking, the idea would is that it would be from this archaic concept of using the old school rungs of the ladder to become a household name. And I think that's the thing we have to start getting our head around is not going to exist anymore. The household name is not going to exist anymore. I can mathematically prove that, and that if you look at 2020 to 2024, the number of household name musicians that have come into existence since this thing came into existence is very few, very few. Olivia Rodrigo, really anyone else, I would argue, was before.
She's a bit of an industry. She's a bit of an industry plant too.
Yeah, and that's
she?
A person who was a Disney star. So that I can't even count that. And it doesn't mean you're not going to make a living.
Of course not.
But this idea of getting a publicist and getting a label and going on TV and being a star, it's more where I think it's kind of heading is more like, well, to really zoom it out.
Mm-hmm.
What was the existence for people who made a living from their hearts and minds before you could even record and replicate things? That's where what it's going to be like.
Yeah, because live performance, you mean.
Right.
Well, I don't know what I mean. What I'm saying is that if you look at the time that on a timeline of all the way back to people taking a skin, tightening it over a log and slapping it, and that's a drum. Let's say that that's 10,000 years ago. I have no idea. To the time that a wax cylinder becomes our first means to actually replicate a sound and play it back.
Yeah.
The point from the creation of recorded music to the creation of the internet where you can suddenly multiply a copy of that recording to infinite regress, or you look at it as that there's just one copy that we all access, that's a tiny, tiny, tiny interval of time. Yet, that interval of time between those two technological inventions has created all of the concepts that we're still working with. Oh, what you do is you make one great catchy tune and then you become a multimillionaire?
Yeah.
What the fuck? That's insane.
I know.
I'm not saying that I don't want to have that happen for me, but I'm just saying our whole bloated sense of these superstar, millionaire, rock star things, that wasn't a thing before you could record music.
Yeah.
That was not a thing. There were like respected composers, court composers, there was brilliance, there was prestige. But this idea of that you're going to be a millionaire and sell a bunch of records and be a household name superstar, that you are like this like cultural artifact as a thing, I don't really know if that's going to be the thing anymore. You might actually be quite faceless. You might, to me, any artist's goal should be to hope that they can make something that's bigger than they could ever be. Who wrote Amazing Grace? We don't know.
Right. As an English guy.
I actually have a whole other thing I'll say about that.
An English fellow.
James's grandfather, actually.
I think he stole that song.
No, I was not nearly posh enough. No, the lyrics I think are British from like an old English. Listen, this is not the point. Please continue.
But yeah, the point being that the best we could hope would be to make a song that lasts out, you know, bigger than us. And
you're talking about the canon. I think like the idea of something like kind of outliving you, because music kind of can be sublime in that way, or like, you know, creativity
more so
can create that.
That success now is going to mean that the best you can hope for. That band is talking about these bands that ask questions.
Yeah.
That they're thinking about how their identity will be brought up into culture. When really that I think that's the wrong thinking. You should be obsessed with the idea of making a piece of art that is so undeniable and so fucking good that it is going to ascend.
Yeah,
I think whether it takes you with you or not, we don't know.
The problem is that we all sit around like, and I, you know, we've all done it, and they all do it. Is that like everybody sits around drinking beers or whatever, and like listening to David Bowie and Prince and the Beatles and all this stuff, and then going on their phone and clicking their explore thing, and it's like videos of them playing and all this stuff, and so we still are just kind of caught in this traditionalism of what it is. And I think it's just hard. Like, you have to be an innovator or have the kind of mind that's willing to like blow the whole thing up and be like, okay, that's not realistic anymore or something. It was great
for
them.
David Bowie in an interview, they asked him, well, I can't remember quite what the question was, and we should go find it later. Maybe, I don't know if you guys do quotes of things later after we discuss them on the podcast, but there's a thing where he distinctly says, had I come about now, I would not have done music. It doesn't feel counterculture to me now. And he's saying that like 30 years ago.
I mean, he's a prescient guy, but he's also a provocateur. I mean, and I think that I've seen interviews with him say he doesn't even like music or listen to it, you know? And I think that's part and parcel of his identity as, you know, a kind but, of gelatin at times. But I don't disagree with what you're saying. And I think that like it is actually like truly optimistic to believe in the power of songs, and you know, which is ostensibly what you're saying, like outside of the kind of complications or like perceived complications around music and around content creation and the way in which we can, you know, meet people feels more fractured, communities feel more fractured, or at least they're online now, so they're not like, you know, embedded within something close to you. We've talked about like curation in that way too, and I think sometimes that's what people are looking for with labels, and they're looking for community. Actually, I don't think it's necessarily about being made more famous. It's like almost in the way that labels used to, you know, like, I mean, Spoon, for example, like, I think that like I probably first heard them because I looked at the label. It might have been Merge at the time that they were on. And I was like, okay, I like bands on that label. That's cool.
I think it's just scary to like, it's just hopeful. If you have a label helping you something, you still have that little bit of glimmer of hope that that might happen for you, like what you're talking about. And it's really terrifying to finally admit like, okay, like this is probably not going to happen. Like I need to think outside the box and do this in a different way. And maybe like you say, give up on my ego and just focus on my art and see where that can go. But I think it's difficult for people now, for young artists to like go there. You know?
You want to make a living. You want to make a good living. If you can make a living from your art, that's so killer, man. If you can get respect, that's so killer. You don't want to be famous.
I would say.
Do you
that
know
that's
how
the,
shitty that is?
I would say that actually that's also being famous, the sort of counterpoint or the counter narrative to what you were saying about like transcendent art and songwriting that kind of is sublime to the point that it kind of lives outside of history, like Amazing Grace maybe or something, and it can take on like it can take on so many different meanings over time. Is that a lot of people? Which is what we're doing, certainly, and certainly it seems like what you're doing is just really trying to put food on the table. And like, if you know, like that is a really, really, like, there's a really strong, I'm extremely proud that like I'm a full-time musician.
And, 100%.
You know, it's an incredible thing. I live in a little one-bedroom place. I've seen your place in Nashville, bit nicer than mine, so kudos to that, but I'm getting there. I like your kind of. I'm a bit more of a minimalist, but I love what you did with the place.
Great job on that renovation. Thank you. I'm a little bit of a carpenter myself at times, and
well,
I really enjoyed that.
Johnny just built himself a house, so if you ever need someone to come down there,
well, maybe come up here and renovate mine in 10 years. I like what you did there. I got all my furniture on Facebook Marketplace too.
I just want to go back to something that you just said. That I mean, I think that the goal of making a living and burrowing down is great, but I do also think that if you really want to make a living at art, there has to be something a little bit wrong with you. And I'm not saying you have to be an addict. I'm not saying you have to have dead parents or something like that, but there has to be some way that you're not, and it's not enviable. Your existence has to be a little bit uncomfortable, and the only way that you're escaping that is to chase the feeling of making something that, that sort of transports you elsewhere.
Definitely.
And that's the obsession for me, and that it's just by pure luck that you end up, if you are lucky, which every year. I mean, the funny thing is, even the people I know who have a lot of success, it seems like they're in the same state of like, oh, this is probably the last year, who knows? You know, that's kind of the way it always feels for me. But now I guess what I'm realizing is like how deeply can you look like Neo in the Matrix and be like, there is no Spoon, and let it bend, which is like not flinching about the money, not flinching about the success or any of it, truly being so out of your mind that you're just going to like do exactly the thing you truly want to do. Because somehow it seems like the people who are the most capable of entering that state do the thing that all of a sudden is.
I would agree with you. I've said it on the podcast before. Like, there's a couple of people that I've met that are, you know, or like I've crossed paths with very, like, you know, liminally. Like they're not my friends. They wouldn't know me, but been around them prior to them becoming really, really successful. Like really the kind of artists you're talking about. Alex Turner from the Arctic Monkeys. When I was a kid, I played some shows with them before they were famous. And then Mac, who lived in Vancouver, Matt DeMarco. And both of those people, in the short amount of time I spent near them, which was very short, they had that. They were definitely doing what you're talking about. You know, they were, you could sense it and feel it, that they were just like truly eccentric in a way that, you know, I don't think I've ever been. And I think recognizing that's kind of important. Maybe that's something you've recognized about yourself. I don't know.
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, I think I've been in it and out of it. I've been maybe at times too much of a pessimist or a realist or too caught in my own thoughts, which I certainly seek to dispose of. But one thing, the last thing I'll say, bringing it back to that topic, just bringing it full circle to the Beatles again, that's why it's so insane, dude, that they were the most famous band in the world. It isn't like Elvis where he's there, some guys in top hats and ties are coming in with the songs and he's going to cut them.
Yeah.
They're the most famous people in the fucking world, and they keep writing it. That part in the documentary, when Paul McCartney is sitting there, and there's the and Ringo and George are there, John's not shown up, the camera guys are there, the audio guys are there, the wives and the Hare Krishnas, there's 35 people in the room. Mm-hmm. And he is sitting there in what he is very aware is the most famous band in the world. And he just reaches up under his ass and writes Get Back in front of everyone. That is the most insane thing I have ever seen. That is the most tapped, insane thing I've ever seen in my life.
Or at least he'd have you believe that.
He's not making it up.
I'm kidding.
He wrote it that morning, clearly, and then he showed up and he's like, Joe was a man. Oh, I think I'm onto something here, George.
Dude, I mean, but just thinking about like how the frequency of somehow...
I know, man.
Looking down, yeah. It's like, how the f- I mean, holy.
Incredible. Paul's one of what I, he's built a little different guy, you know, he's got that kind of intensity you're talking about that he just lives and breathes it. It's in every story that he go, every time he went to a party or to anyone's house, it's straight to the piano. He's playing 24 hours a day, all day long. It's all he wants to do is write and create and produce and do stuff. I know what you mean. Like those seem to be the people that. Yeah. That just get stuff done.
It's a slight sort of segue, but we're going to talk about it on Sunday. But I don't know, Max, if you've seen the We Are the World new Netflix documentary. I don't know if you watched it.
I have, and actually, what I really enjoy about it is that I had already been obsessed with that footage existed on YouTube for years.
I've been showing
it to people. Like, watch this, man.
It's crazy.
To me, I was always obsessed with Bob Dylan looking so uncomfortable. To me, what I drew from it is it's a great moment of what a truly great producer does, because Bob Dylan is folding in half and blowing it, and Quincy Jones walks up and goes, "Oh, that's beautiful, Bobby. I just sing that one. This is the first time." And he just calms him down.
Quincy's good. I know.
He doesn't
master class in producing.
And then the other part that I was always obsessed with before it had been cut into a documentary is the part where, you know, Michael's just standing there like this Jedi waiting as these buffoons just hack their way and can't sing the song. And every time he steps up and plays and sings that "When It Down and Out" and "It Seems No Hole Better," it's like, holy shit.
It's bizarre. It's like,
he sings that thing exactly the same. And the you can hear the way he's resonating the fucking room
when bizarre. He sings it.
And then Huey Lewis, "When you just believe, there's no way we can fall."
Well, we learn a little bit about Huey taking. So that was meant to be Prince, Johnny, just so you know.
I'm going to watch it for Sunday. Yeah,
we're going to get really deep into it on Sunday, and you're welcome back to talk about it.
I hope I didn't spoil it.
No, one thing that I will spoil this, but it's not really a spoiler, is talking about songwriting and like, you know, obviously. It's trite to some extent because we're talking about the song "We Are the World," but there's a bit in the documentary where Lionel Richie talks about going over to Michael Jackson's house because they need to write the song. Like, they haven't even written it and they've got like a few days. And I thought the way he explained his process was so strange. Like, he was like, first we had to decide what kind of song it was. So he's like, da, 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 da. No, not that beat. And they figure out like what beat they want from thinking of songs like Amazing Grace, like ba, 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 ka, ba. Okay, that's going to be that's our template. Now let's just write a song. Should be easy. It's a ballad. And then they kind of just do that. Like he literally decides,
as good as Amazing Grace, is it?
Well, he doesn't use Amazing Grace as the reference. I can't remember what it is, but it is like he just chooses like a kind of, a rhythm from something that is, you know, huge and almost like within our cultural psyche, like it kind historically.
Chariots of Fire.
Sure, whatever. Yeah, well, maybe not Chariots of Fire. Maybe, I don't know. And, yeah, but and that's how they start writing it. Like that's their template. That's their template. Yeah. Their logic template. You know.
Yeah. You know, I want to say one thing because I was thinking about it this morning, and it's kind of what we were talking about. I was listening to Pet Sounds,
pretty
and
good
like what you're talking about with Paul and Get Back and all that, and these types of people. I was listening to Pet Sounds, and I thought, you know why this is such an amazing record is because not only if Brian Wilson had written those songs, it would be incredible. They're such beautiful songs. But not only did he do that, I was thinking about it, but he showed up to the studio every day with charts for each individual musician and what they were going to play, like the bass lines, you know, everything that was going to happen for all of the instruments. And then I was like, okay, well, that's not super impressive because great arrangers like Quincy Jones or people like that would have done that for Sinatra or whoever, Nelson Riddle. But I thought that that must be the first time that anybody ever did all of that and sang on the record and was on the front of the cover. And I was thinking that that's must have just been so special for people like Paul McCartney and to see and all that. And that kind of was maybe puts him a cut above.
Maybe put him in the sand pit too, you know, just broke.
Exactly. And drove him mad, right? So I thought that was cool.
Yeah, you know, everyone says he's so crazy, but he seems normal to me in interviews when he's talking. I don't know. He doesn't seem like he's lost his mind. I did hear one story about him.
He definitely lost his mind.
A friend of mine, a producer friend of mine, was at some award show and says, I'm trying to remember, maybe this is a story he heard or something. But, is it Don Henley?
Great
comes
guy.
Comes up to Brian Wilson and has a Pet Sounds and goes, hey, would you sign this for me? And he goes, sure, yeah. And he says, like, to Don, thanks for the great music. And he signs it and he's about to hand it back and he goes, oh, and he takes it and he crosses out great and he writes good. And he hands it back.
Savage.
But apparently that's not something he did to be mean, that he's just like, he's just unwell.
Right.
And that was an example. You know, I've had conversations with certain people that there is, there's capital G great records that really only a handful of things in time fall into, the Pet Sounds being one of them for sure.
Yeah.
And, and you know.
What else would you put up there?
Probably a couple of
songs. I was going to ask you, before we go, your favorite Beatles album and song. Do you have one?
I think Magical Mystery Tour is kind of the sleeper cousin of Sgt. Pepper that, to me, has the slappier stuff. I mean, Strawberry Fields at so many levels is just one of the most insane things ever made.
Yeah, that's a good one.
Well, Johnny's
sure.
hot take, if you were to get rid of one Beatles record and replace it with Pet Sounds, which is kind of back on your kind of brackety rank, because we've ranked all these records against each other in a kind of March Madness thing, Sgt. Pepper's goes for Johnny.
Wow, I would. You can't now.
Yeah, I would, yeah.
I'm sorry you can't do it. It's a terrible idea. You've got to do the White Album.
Oh, no, that's my... That's
no
my
big singles. There's no big singles on the way.
That's my number one.
Yeah, I think that's
your number one.
Could be.
Yeah, White Album and probably Please Please Me. I like the first one a lot.
Yeah,
Abbey
look,
Road.
Honestly, I'd be chopping up like something older. Honestly, anything pre Rubber Soul.
You'll get rid of one of them.
I mean, great. I think the early stuff. I think the early stuff when they're just such a powerful,
optimistic,
like catchy, like recording quickly in the studio, and they have that young, youthful enthusiasm. That stuff, and then the late period stuff, like kind of White Album on, to me is the strongest stuff. I mean, I love every single Beatles record and song that they ever made, and everybody has opinions about this, but yeah, the mid-period psychedelic stuff, obviously Strawberry Fields Forever and all that is, you know, I'm not going to ever say anything bad about that, but if I had to pick, I do like the early and late periods the best for me.
Interesting.
But
yeah, I guess for me, the White Album, I mean, and I've listened to it a lot. In fact, I think when I was in high school, it was one of the only vinyls I had that I was...
Did you have the poster with it?
No.
A really nice poster inside.
The photos, with the photos.
But White Album is like, it's like them really taking the piss, which has some great, like, obviously they never miss, like they're always, there's just songs that are great. But Sgt. Pepper, man, there's no way you can knock that one. Cause it's just like, they're set free. I don't know. It's like just so smart what they're doing. It's like,
the production's incredible and it changed the world and all that kind of stuff. Like, obviously, culturally, everything, like, it ticks all those boxes. I'm purely just talking about some of the songs, like, I don't love as much as some
of
the
others. Like, which song are you not loving?
Like, Being for the Benefit of Mr. Kite, Good Morning, Good Morning, She's Leaving Home, I Like Now. I used to, like, they're great songs.
With a Little Help from My Friends?
Well, that's one of my favorite all-time Beatles songs,
Come
With a Little Help from My Friends. But
Lucy in the Sky with
Diamonds. It's kind of seems a bit, I don't know. I mean, just this is fun to just talk Beatles, but like some of it's Paul.
When I'm
kind
64?
Of getting a, he's a little bit, Paul's just kind of like a little bit, feeling
being
himself
Paul?
A bit.
Their character acting, man. I mean, that's something that Lennon does, especially on the White Album. Like when you listen to I'm So Tired, it's like he's literally like making, he's doing these characters.
It's awesome.
That's so soulful
intense. No.
Like,
if we really talk about it, then maybe the White Album is the best one. Maybe it's the one I couldn't take.
I think the thing about the White Album is like what I like about it is like how, and it's, you know, it follows up from what you're saying. Like, how do you follow Sgt. Pepper's? Like, you just throw everything at it, like, you know, and it's
Mystery Tour was after Sgt. Pepper's, right?
No, Sgt. Pepper's White Album.
I mean, it's hard to probably Mystery Tour, I guess, but like weirdly, it wasn't like an album, right? So it's kind of hard to say because it was like Strawberry Fields, Penny Lane, and all that were all singles that they slapped on after
I think it's between the two, but I sort of think
came
of
out
it.
Like this as two 45s that just had only the first side. What most people know is side A of Magical Mystery Tour, and side B was all singles.
Full on the Hill, like, is a slam dunk. I mean, honestly, I think
it's good.
I'm the really Walrus.
Full on the Hill's good.
Top.
Yeah, level. I'm the Walrus. Yeah, it's good. I listened to it the other day. Like, I threw it on. I have a new infant daughter.
Yeah.
And I threw on I Am the Walrus and I was like, fuck, this is pretty like demented. So I was I put it on and turned it up and out. Like, my wife came in and she was like, this is it's too crazy at like 11 o'clock on a Wednesday to throw that song on.
Man,
you know?
I love that song.
I was loving it.
Okay, what about like, you know, similarly like Rumors and then Tusk, Fleetwood Mac? It's a similar kind of, you know, a similar operation there in my mind where it's like you've made this like pretty focused record. Last.
If Max picked Tusk, I'd be shocked.
I'd be shocked.
No, yeah, I wouldn't. No, it's Rumors, dude. Yeah, I don't try to be too cool. Like, I'm definitely just like, give me the hits.
I don't think it's about...
With the Beatles, it's just all hits.
I don't think it's about...
But they're all hits
with
the
Beatles. I think it can be easily... You could diagnose it as trying to be cool, for sure. And, like, there is, like, Pitchforkian records, of course. Like, Tusk would win out over Rumors. But
yeah, Tusk...
Are you guys big Radiohead people, or is that
I'm not, no.
Interesting.
Not really. I mean, when I was in high school, I had OK Computer and...
Yeah,
I kind Everybody of left that. Off. That's where I finished. Was OK Computer because I got into the Strokes and stuff. I kind of
be no Radiohead without the White Album. Just saying.
That's true.
What do you guys think?
I mean,
that?
There would be no Radiohead without the Beatles for sure. But I would say that Radiohead, in a weird way, sort of is like kind of in a weird way, kind of the closest thing to the Beatles that I think
for Radiohead
happened.
Fans, it is for sure.
I think Liam Gallagher would have something to say about that.
Separately, speaking of Manchester accents, if we're talking about deep YouTube gems that have, I think, yet to really see the correct light of day, there is a highlight reel of Noel Gallagher's commentary from the fan DVDs on their own music videos that I highly recommend to you. I will
that
send
sounds
it to you.
Really good.
It's
that
someone sounds. Cut together the highlights of him watching. All you hear is the audio of him talking about these videos as they're being played, I guess he's being asked to come in and talk about them, like to like for the fans or whatever. But he's of course not. He's like, "Oh, it was a fucking shit day that was." I was pissed right. And
I think I might have seen one or two of those. Yeah, I think I might have seen one or two of those things. Like, but yeah, that sounds great. Yeah, you're good at his voice too. Better than me doing it. It's too close to my voice.
And I don't really know what he's talking about. I mean, one part of it that always sticks in my mind that I just hear for the rest of my life is they're showing the video for Live Forever.
Yeah.
And he starts talking about shit about how lame it is to even do videos and how he's over the process at that point and he's just sick of it and they're just making up nonsense. And he goes, he's like, I remember at one point the director told me to, if I could have a bit more energy in my eyes. And he goes, I still don't know what he meant by that. It's just this stale.
He did a good April Fool's joke yesterday. Hey, that he tweeted that Oasis was reuniting. He's like, fuck it, I'm in. Let's do it.
Oh, that's funny.
And everybody went fucking bonkers.
Can you imagine?
Biggest reunion that has never happened, probably. Sure.
Can you imagine being such a whiny, insane guy that you can't hang out with your brother and play hits for millions of dollars? Can you imagine that?
No.
I think about that as a possibility, because I can't.
I feel like my assumption is that they'll just do it when they want, you know?
Yeah. They're just building the hype, probably. Not that there needs to be much more. I mean, they could probably still sell out. Like
first couple are good.
So Oasis is a bigger thing for you guys than Radiohead.
I would say I was a bigger Oasis fan when I was a kid. Yeah,
I think the urgency of those first two records, and especially like being a kid in Manchester and what it represented, it represented something very hopeful. You know, that it was possible. I think that there's something slightly too sophisticated and reflective or about Radiohead for me. I always found, like, I'm pretty nerdy, but I always found it just a little bit too, it was just like, I had to have a degree to understand it or something, you know?
Yeah.
The people that liked it really liked it and explained it to me in a way that felt like they weren't talking about music. But, you know, I do think that they're good, and I think that, like, the way in which they kind of worked their music, the way in which they embraced technological changes, and the way in which, like, I was saw a thing the other day about, like, remember when they did their like thing in like their live thing in the basement? They like live streamed themselves, like that was so cool. Early, like,
yeah, that was cool,
crazy early to be doing. So. And then obviously,
and they dropped in Rainbows, and they were like, "It's free, just it's pay free. What you want."
And
that, like, was genius.
Yeah, absolutely insane, like what they were doing. You know, like the anti Lars Ulrich model of, like, you know, recognizing that these things are bigger than you. But yeah, I think
it was a bit too smart for me too. By the time it came around, like you're saying, and then I was already like into Led Zeppelin and stuff or something, and I was like, I can't be bothered with this. And then I started listening to like music that's quote unquote like cool and intellectual like that. I just went straight to Tusk or something, you know what I mean? Or like the other ones we're talking about.
You guys should, man, if I can leave you with anything, I really, that In Rainbows record, go back and just, you know, if you're on a drive or
try
something,
it again,
go back and swim through that one. And the Bends, dude, that album after they have Pablo,
I know the
Honey,
Bends. I'm good.
God,
with
God, it's pretty good.
That was,
man,
of course, yeah. I don't know if I
need to hear Fake Plastic Trees again in my life. Honestly,
Fake Plastic Trees is on. What is that on?
I think it's on the Bends.
Is it really?
Yeah, I think.
Or Pablo Honey.
I think it's after one after, isn't it?
You know, I think that's on. Oh shit, it is
Street
on the Bends.
Something as well.
Look at you
one.
Go. You
Street
are,
Spirit.
You
I remember learning
Spirit.
That one on the guitar,
oh, yeah,
that cool
riff.
A
I'm
minor
like
picking.
I'm a
thing.
Fan of this band, and you guys are like, yeah, it's on this album. I don't even have the album straight.
Yeah, it's not about that.
Don't worry.
You know what?
You guys,
there's plenty of music, and that's what's wonderful about music, you know?
I mean, you can
learn more about it every day. You're like, I don't know In Rainbows. I'll check it out. It's probably fucking good.
I will too.
Dude, that was like, I remember, because you got to think about how by the time I got to high school, albums were almost over, man. It was an iTunes singles thing. Albums were not a thing. That was one of the last times
albums.
I remember an album coming out.
Yeah,
and everyone being like, we are all listening to this. Like people who you would never think would listen to
Radiohead.
It was
definitely a get together
girls in high
and
school
to
who
it.
Like played lacrosse were like listening to Radiohead. And
I mean,
album,
no one should be playing lacrosse. So
yeah,
that's true.
Yeah.
That's our
field
national
hockey.
Sport. That's our national sport, lacrosse, in Canada here.
Beavers are our national animal.
If you can believe that. Definitely. I'll go check out In Rainbows. Hey, I'm going to throw on Sgt. Pepper again. Give it another chance. You know what I mean? I'm inspired.
Have you ever read the Clapton autobiography?
Sounds terrifying.
You know what? I have it, dude. I have it, and I've never cracked it.
I'll get to the best part of the Clapton autobiography, which is the part where he tries acid for the first time.
Yeah.
And he's taken to a club in somewhere in wherever the hell he is, I guess in London. I don't remember. And he's on acid for the first time, and he's talking about how it starts to hit, and he feels really good, and he's in like this back apartment that's like above this club. And John and Paul show up, and they're like, we just got the press of this record we just did. It's called Sgt. Pepper. You want to hear it? And he listens to Sgt. Pepper on acid with the Beatles for the first time. If he's, I mean, I think he's not making that up, but that sounds, that's insane.
That sounds like definitely something that would be, you would want to experience.
Did you see, we can sign off here, did you see the, talking about Clapton, did you see that it was his birthday the other day and the band tweeted at him? Did you see what they
said? Oh, yeah.
Happy birthday, Eric Clapton. This year we got you a new guitar strap, just in case.
Savage, dude.
Savage.
Not what letting does that mean?
If, in because the last in the waltz, last... Yeah, please, Johnny. Yeah.
Oh, in the last waltz, Eric Clapton comes out and famously is playing a guitar solo and his strap breaks. And then Robbie... pick right away is ready and just rips a way better solo right away than Clapton was playing. And there's like a conspiracy theory that Robbie like Robbie messed with the strap, the knob of the strap or whatever, so that it would happen. He had the whole thing planned.
This you guys may just look at me like I'm crazy or not know what I'm talking about here. But that's one of the weird things in all of music history to me is what happened to Eric Clapton's guitar playing from Cream to all time after that.
I think he just was blues. All he ever could do was blues anyway, really, that kind of style. But in Cream, he it was like the 60s, everything was so colorful. He had the wah-wah pedal and all the psychedelia going on that sort of made the blues slightly more interesting. And then he decided to just go straight blues and it was kind of boring, maybe.
I can't quite concur with that assessment. I would say that to me, I mean, yeah, there's definitely some factors there of psychedelia that seem more present in the music of Cream, but the playing, when he's playing solos in Cream, he's slower, his tone is fat, he's like stoic, and he sounds like Albert King on steroids, and it's this sick thing. And then all of a sudden, he gets a Strat, and he got some Birkenstocks.
Yeah.
And he comes out and he's like, bim, ba-lilum, bim, ba-lilum, bim, ba-lilum, bim, ba-lilum. He just starts dinky. He just
probably
became this
drugs
dinky
and booze
dinker
a bit.
Yeah. And also business heroin acumen, you know. He found a way to kind of, you know, the 80s were his, you know, they're really his kind of, it's his decade, you know. He found a way to, you know, kind of get his music into like corporate boardrooms and things like that.
He's had an insane career for how,
mediocre he is.
He kind of is in a way,
Well, listen, man. I just want to say it's been really nice talking to you, and quite nice, kind of heated philosophical debate. And also, you don't know this, but this was actually kind of a surreptitious business meeting because we're looking for someone to help us get viral with our reels on Instagram.
Here's what we got to do:
pitch in with any kind of. You've got the gig. That's what I'm saying. And,
all right, you ready? So here's what we're gonna do. We're gonna get some short clips out of this video. First, we'll just bat this one around for a second. It'll be like us talking like in a podcast. Like, hey, guy, you know what's so sick about the Chinese government?
Okay.
You know what's awesome about the Chinese government? Let me tell you guys about what's so sick about China and why you shouldn't question anything that's coming from over there.
Then
you guys respond. We'll edit that together, and that's how you go viral on TikTok right now.
Well done, yeah.
Okay, we'll try that. We'll try it out. I mean, I don't know if I'm ready to do that yet, but, you know, maybe if that's what it takes, I'll do it.
You know what I love about communism? Is no.
No, exactly.
That's the clip that you get to go viral.
Well, Max Frost, thanks for coming on.
Thanks for having
everybody
me, guys.
Check out his music and follow him on Instagram and TikTok. And Max, we'd love to have you back, man.
Love Anytime, talking man. To you, buddy.
Pleasure chatting with you guys.
We can do the 1 second Beatles challenge next time you come on. It's fun times.
Okay,
we're talking
great.
About that. All right.
Excellent.
All right, take care, buddy.
Till then.
Bye-bye.